Due to a technical problem, we join this presentation a few minutes late. We apologize for the inconvenience.
Tell you that clearly that's the number one theme with theme today in terms of discussions in our community is around the budget issues, the fiscal stress, continuing probably on through 2013 and perhaps 14. Many of you from states know that states will come out of this recession later than the federal government and the national economy because of lagging revenue receipts, and it's probably be, as some predict, as late as 2014 before states are back to the revenue levels they had in 2008. So this is going to be a long situation, and so I think as we talk today, one of the things I would mention is that we expect to see some major structural reforms in government, and back to that old, I guess, adage about perhaps particularly in state government, you may see states looking at where their sweet spot is, and that is probably more steering and less rowing. And in the IT community, that means more outsourcing, that means more privatization. State governments, clearly from a policy perspective, are good at steering, and some would argue that they're maybe not so good at rowing, and particularly in the IT community. And we see that already in a number of states, where states have begun to either selectively outsource vertical activities or, in fact, do wholesale outsourcing of their entire IT environment to private firms on multi-year contracts. So that's certainly one of the things I would bring to you today. I guess the other would be that the CIOs clearly, since they live in that fishbowl, they're swimming in that water. And so they have to deal with these constant changes around the emerging technologies, the speed to which technology is advancing, and records and digital records and electronic records, clearly part of that the water that they're swimming in. They have to deal with that. And NASIO has been addressing these issues and educating and reminding them, and many of them obviously have taken that to task. There needs to be a lot more discussion around that, particularly because of the born digital content. I would also tell you in terms of just kind of general opening comments as for a kind of an easy way as I talk to groups to think about what's going on in that both the CIO world, but also just the state IT community. I always feel like Alex Trebek in this issue is that these are all words that so Doug, give me words that end in T-I-O-N, and it's consolidation, virtualization, collaboration. You know, so it's a mix of technical issues as well as business model issues, but certainly the top of the list would be consolidation, and that is the grand unification theory, as some CIOs would like to argue, but certainly the trying to remove a lot of the diversity and a lot of the technology that has grown up in a distributed and highly decentralized world, which can be not really cost effective from the standpoint of state government holistically. And virtualization as a technology has been number one on our list of priorities from the association and from the CIO community for the last 3 years, and that is, again, virtualizing the environment of hardware and software to minimize the numbers of kinds, to reduce, again, that diversity, but also to optimize the spend, the IT investments. States, just to give you a perspective, the IT spend around the states collectively is anywhere between $40 and $45 billion, depending on what analysts you talk to. So it's a very robust area, and over the next 2 years, our own survey released 2 weeks ago noted that about two-thirds, 64-65% of the CIOs have experienced budget cuts and expect to continue those cuts through 2013. There's a small number that actually have shown an increase and about 25% that say they're pretty much flat. So this is not an area of the growth where they have to basically continue with the phrase that I hate, do more with less, but that's what they're faced with today. So I can talk more about some of the other areas and kind of reflect on how that impacts the discussion with electronic records and preservation, particularly our interest in digital preservation and born digital content, which has presented the CIOs with many, many challenges because they really weren't prepared. They're prepared to run the email environment for 50,000 inboxes. They're not prepared for the question, okay, where is it when an e-discovery subpoena comes in from the judge? So that's something that we have to address. So I'm glad to be here and fight with Matt about certain things.
Thank you. We should have called this the SmackDown session or something. It's not surprising, of course, that the economy is the biggest issue in people's minds. I'm sure if we took a poll, that's number one. I am intrigued, though, by Jackie's comment about the opportunities that the budget crisis presents. And so I wonder just if our panelists have thoughts on what opportunities does this economic climate present in terms of your own situation and Archives and Records Management?
Well, it's kind of hard to say where the opportunities lie when you don't have any money, although what we have found, and some of you have had a chance to talk to Dave Cheever, we are preparing for the upcoming sesquicentennial of the American Civil War. And Maine, among all the states, has some of the most incredible collections of Civil War records and of any state in the country. And the reason for that is actually something that is a little bit counterintuitive. You know, first of all, it wasn't just because we're great record keepers, which apparently we are, but we have like just incredible piles of information. We actually came across bound volumes of all the telegrams that were sent from the Capitol to the troops in the field and back. So while email is a challenge, Doug, our T-mail is well taken care of. But the reason the Adjutant General made the decision to keep every single record was very similar to what we're going through today, which was the state of Maine in 1860 was flat broke and had no money. And they were going to get the maximum value out of every penny to make sure that people were paid properly. They said, we're going to keep good records. We don't know. Frankly, the rarefication of funds right now is not something I generally see as an opportunity, but it could well develop into one in 100 years. So we'll see.
Well, many people, and I have to comment on some comments that he made earlier, many people who want records from the counties want that opportunity to just go to their computers and get what they need. They don't want to have to go to the offices. They don't want to have to pay their money in person. But they also, don't want anybody else to be able to get their record online. And that's a challenge for a lot of people. Now, one example is a property record. Now, one of the things that I do on a regular basis is that I find people based on the property record software that's available on county websites. I can actually find people by just going in and putting their name in large amounts of software, and I can find out where they live, how much they pay for their house, how long they've been there. But guess what? The new opportunity, and this is what I mean about opportunities, there's opportunities to take new software, some of the things that are not really too costly, and make information available, but also make it private. If you go to property websites in Colorado and Washington State, most of the counties don't have a search by name. You have to have the parcel number or the lot number, not even just the address. So I'm thinking as I'm looking, I'm going, oh, they're making this harder for me to get access. I can't find people as easily as I could, but that's a good thing. And the reality is when you're working smarter, you're working harder, you take advantage of things that are out there. This piece of software, now I don't know how much it costs, but it is making the data that is available online more secure and making their residents feel safer simply because they know they can't be searched by their name or their address. But, you know, I know what my parcel number is. I know what my lot number is, so if I want access, I can get it. That's what I call an opportunity, to work better, smarter, take advantage of a lot of the opportunities that are out there. Maybe you don't have enough money to build that new building that you want, or to get those extra cabinets that you want, or to get that new scanner, but maybe you can buy that new software and show and make a point of letting everybody know your data is more secure on our county website. So I see those kinds of things as the things you can do, even in an economic downturn, but you have to sit down and make those decisions. I can't do this, but what can I do? I've got fewer people. I have to work smarter. Everybody knows we have hiring freezes. We have counties that have laid off over 1,000 people. So when you see this coming down the pike, you still have to do the job that your office is designed to do. You've still got to be as responsive or more responsive if you can be, and use the tools that are out there. Use some of that new software. Work with the people in neighboring communities. Come to meetings like this. I say, I have this term I use. I call it LBWA. I tell our members about it at my conferences. I tell everybody I know. It's called learning by walking around. And you talk to your peers. You find out who's doing what. Look up the best practices. Think smart, work smart, and it's a good opportunity for you to make your working system stay as efficient as you can, meet the needs of your clients, and also, as much as you can, maintain their privacy and give them what they want as a record online.
Back to my words that end in T-I-O-N. in terms of the state CIO community and just the state IT environment in general, consolidation has definitely been the major opportunity around cost savings and around reorganization. But it comes with obviously some danger. It comes with potential for skirmishes around "you're not the boss of me" conversations. As I told Matt, the CIO's ultimate vision is world domination, pure omnipotence over all publicly elected officials, including constitutional officers.
Well, we know.
It's an arrogant bunch.
This session is being recorded, by the way. I forgot to
tell you. Well, we've put it out there. I think that, the challenge here is really gets down to that consolidation, and we've done. And please go to NASIO's website, and you can download almost all of our surveys, materials, and research reports are available to the public in a digital format that probably is not going to survive archiving. However, the trends that we track clearly around the consolidation is one where we've benchmarked that years ago. Last year we did another survey. We checked with the CIOs on where consolidation ranked in their top three. 80% of the states are involved in some consolidation, and some of the ones that didn't answer, South Dakota, North Dakota, they're already fully consolidated. And by that I mean the IT resources, in some cases even the budget and the personnel, are all within one organization. And so some would question that, particularly if you're in an agency in a state government that has been under that mandate. But what we're seeing is, rather than it simply being a whim or a vision of the CIO, it's now become a legislative mandate. It's become an executive order. It's become cast in stone that you shall go forth and consolidate. What's happened during the current fiscal stress is that opportunity has accelerated, because there's a window again that's that silver lining for them to look at that. It needs to be done in a very organized and in a very thought-provoking fashion. And it requires a lot of conversations, but we certainly see that as continuing trend of that, and also what I'll call infrastructure optimization, another T-I-O-N word, because states for many, many years have operated under what I've called the Baskin-Robbins architecture. They've had 31 flavors of everything, whether they need it or not. So that states that sit today and have 7 or 8 different email systems really have to question whether there's a business rationale for doing that when you're using taxpayer dollars to support those things. So we obviously wax on eloquently about these issues around opportunities, and clearly that is one. And then, of course, the friction on that comes with the various independent agencies and other offices where there could be legitimate business rationale. There could be an exception to what they need to do, but the basic infrastructure, what I call the infrastructure and the plumbing that supports state government, can be fairly harmonious. It doesn't have to be so diverse, and again, cost the taxpayers money. So that's been the discussion and the debate over the last year and a half or 2 years around the CIO community, is those states that had been, in a sense, reluctant or recalcitrant, been laggards in that, now you see them breaking out, and we have states that have had 32 or 33 data centers that are now down to 2 and 3, because it just makes business sense to do that. So,
I think that the issue of consolidation, which has been sort of the cutting edge of government procurement and how, especially how we handle technology, there is another TIO N word there, and that's saturation. There's only really so much that you can achieve with consolidation, and what we've found is that there is a certain critical mass that you reach when you consolidate to a certain degree. And there is the issue of the separate branches of government and who controls the valves that make information flow. And there are some serious political ramifications around that as well. But getting to the issue of consolidating information, and this is in two different vectors, and I'm going to probably have Adrian weigh in on this too. The issue of where you store information and how you store information, there are some serious risks associated with that. While people expect information to be available to them rapidly, easily, conveniently, it also has to have integrity and verifiability as well, especially with electronic information. We've all seen the horror stories about, you know, students, you know, looking up stuff on Wikipedia, you know, and it's something that somebody made up. I mean, so the value of an original record has really no true measure. But how you store those records, and, you know, probably about 80% of our vital records in the state of Maine are not held in the state archives or in the vital records office, which, by the way, is in a floodplain, which we keep pointing out to them, you know, it's like, and it's a pretty active floodplain. You know, you get down in Hallowell, they have one of the buildings in Hallowell where they actually have marked the floods, you know, up way up high on the wall. You know, the last one was, I think, 1987. It's about 10 feet up, you know. And that's where they keep all the birth certificates, which is just a brilliant, brilliant idea. You know, and it gets into disaster management, which is something that we don't like to talk about very much in this business. You look what happened in the Gulf Coast, in the hurricane, and vertical columns of information were lost. We moved very quickly in Maine, and we developed a reciprocal agreement with both Mississippi and Louisiana that we would honor credentials regardless of what was behind them because they had lost birth certificates. You had your birth certificate. The original copy was gone, too. So that's, and then you had that huge fire in St. Louis in the Military Records Center some years back where millions of military records were lost. So I think, you know, given the space issues at archives, which, by the way, and anybody who went to the reception last night, Dave and I walked around. We just skipped all the food. The exhibits were magnificent that they put on. And every time I go down to the National Archives, I kind of walk around with a combination of a little tear here and foam right there. And it's just an amazing place. The problem of having either digital records kept on a server that then is subject to a fire or, you know, your paper records kept in one building, which then floods or burns down. You know, where we have 80% of our records in small town offices, museums, county courthouses, I'll just throw that out there, David. Unexpected question, what is the value of diffusion versus consolidation? Adrian, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're pretty distributed around the country, so, but you've got original records, and it's one copy, one kind of record here. It's not duplicated elsewhere. You can do that with electronic records, but the idea that you can, with the volume of paper records and other media that we have, do something like digitize them all so that you've got copies and can make them available, you know, that's somebody's wild dream and bears no relationship to reality. I think that the impact of within the federal government, which is going to be an opportunity for us and also a curse, is that right now I think agencies are going to be more interested in transferring their records to the National Archives, particularly those that are stored in our Federal Record Center system, because they have to pay for storage and servicing. So we've seen some movement, which maybe have been anticipatory of the budget cuts that were coming, but we've been working with the courts on the federal district court records, of which there are tremendous volumes spread across the regional archives. And the schedule that they were transferred under was bad, just plain bad. And so we've worked on a new schedule, and they're very interested in making sure that the sampling that has to be done to make sure that records are transferred and those that aren't going to be transferred disposed of happens quickly so that they can reduce their storage bill. OPM, they have responsibility for all of the civilian personnel records that have ever been created in the government. They, too, we have a new schedule with OPM. to transfer those records. Until the budget cuts came, even though they had to start paying for their storage 10 years ago, there just wasn't any pressure for them to do anything about it. So, you would try to get schedules signed and records transferred, and it was kind of, in the fullness of time, we'll do it. But I think the budget climate is definitely going to have an impact on the transfer of records to us, which is something that we want. On the other hand, it obviously complicates our space problem. So, as I said, it's an opportunity. It's also a curse.
Can I answer Matt's question?
No,
it's a very good question. I mean, it's fundamental to this discussion around kind of emerging trends around it, because that's a debate that every state certainly has around whether it's physical records. And clearly, I'm going to focus on the digital side in the digital environment, and that is one of the utility around decentralized and diffused environment versus a consolidated or centralized one. And that is what every CIO has to struggle with, because that's the discussion that comes up. And there's certain things that I think become religious wars that clearly don't really fit into this mix around certain applications. When you get into these large environments that certainly generate tons of digital records, that is a question that's always confronting them. And I think it's one of single point of failure discussions around a system that has a proliferation of critically important records in digital form that need to be maintained. And I think the challenge here is that you've got a major trust in government discussion going on. 65% of the public does not trust government to do the right thing with their information, as Jacqueline said. That's a known issue. And the trust in leadership is probably even worse today, if you've seen the latest polls. So we've got a real challenge there, and yet at the same time you're being pressured in the great squeeze play around the budget is how do you again optimize this, and how do you control costs? And one way you do that is through consolidation. So CIOs are faced with that challenge of being directed to control their costs, knowing that consolidation is their best strategy, is their best opportunity among others to do that. But certainly it's the biggest bang for the buck. So they have to look at that question around redundancy and resiliency and scalability, and also knowing that if they do that, if they migrate all these data centers and some of them that are not being managed well, they don't have those disciplines around that. And I think when you look at so again, extend this conversation into records management and digital archiving, that's what you want, is disciplines. Just as CIOs are working around disciplines such as enterprise architecture and ITIL and COBIT and security certificate, all those disciplines around their work, you want to have that same discipline, and I think that's going to be the big challenge. So it's going to require some continued collaboration, and I think this debate's going to continue around whether it does make long-term sense to have this. But I think if anything, I would argue that it will continue, and we may have to look at services. And from the local government side, what states are seeing are local governments in this fiscal squeeze are actually now which is amazing. It's, lions and lambs lying down together. Local governments coming to the state and saying, take over my environment. Here are my servers. Here are my applications. We have many examples of that, where the local governments are moving their applications and systems to the state data center because they need that support. They need that rigorous control, business continuity, disaster recovery, backup that they can't pay for. Just as Adrian mentioned, the records, the agencies having to make that decision, local governments, and that's a very we certainly didn't predict that 5 years ago, that I'd call the extended enterprise model would come out. So then what's the implication for records? Local government records now residing in the state data center. The local governments are still the custodians, and they have to negotiate deals. The other thing I would point out in terms of the challenges, and these are all around how you all frame this, and in fact, Matt can respond to this because they're one of the states. 23 states now outsource their state portals. 23 states outsource their state portals, meaning that .gov property you landed on is actually, run by a private firm, meaning that the servers, the search engines, the environment, the states are responsible for the content, but everything supporting that portal is actually being run by a private firm. And in a couple of instances, that environment actually is in another state. So they've decided to reduce their cost by saying, we'll use your data center. And so when you go to, that state.gov, you're actually not even in that state So that's a virtualization that's taken place.
Let me broaden that just a little bit, because as you were talking about consolidation and such, it seems often to almost inevitably lead to outsourcing. There's an entire trend toward different control of information. We see it in terms of the public demanding access to the raw data so that they can mash it up in the way that they want. They want to tag the information. The states want you to give their information to IBM to take care of. How is that a positive thing, a negative thing? How does that affect archives and records management?
I think that's actually a very good topic, because, you know, Doug's right. We are one of those states that uses a partnership with an outside vendor to build and maintain our state portal. The issue of information and who controls information is one that we're really grappling with, especially when you get into the issue of bulk information, you know, and
for sale.
For sale, and in some cases for policy reasons, for very good reasons. And, you know, we deal with about 1 million driving records that are turned over every month through the major vendors of information, mostly around actuarial information around insurance. So, you know, insurance companies buy this information, and that's how they determine what your insurance rate. They get your driving record every month. So if you've had, you know, a drunk driving arrest or something like that, that's why your insurance rates go up, because they can check and see. Now, that's a fairly simple iteration, and we have agreements through the vendor with those other companies that they don't resell the information. You know, we get complaints quite frequently, and this, to make this even an even broader discussion, but we can only control the information that we receive. When a member of the public gets a robocall about getting, you know, insurance rates, how do they know to call me? Is the state selling this information? In fact, the state isn't. But if you go to get your tires changed, they keep a database of their own. When you get your oil changed, they keep a database of their own, and they sell their databases. So that call can be coming from any one of about 100 different directions, not necessarily from government. To make it worse, the federal law, the Driver Privacy Protection Act, prohibits motor vehicle officials from releasing any information about a driver without a submission of proprietary information, namely the driver's license number or the date of birth. It doesn't prohibit anybody else from releasing that information if they have access to it, including police departments, investigation units, anybody who would have access to the data, which can include some other third-party vendors. So that's another one of the cautionary watchwords about the issue of consolidation. We've also gone through the issue in county government in Maine, where in a broader scale, a law firm FOIA'd all the crash reports that are held by the state police, so they could get the driver information and then contact them. We call it electronic ambulance chasing to get that contact information.
Pesky lawyers.
But also because counties sell deed information, you know, that type of thing. That was also FOIA'd as well, and a court case came that said that they could provide it at a cost, but it had to be a quote-unquote reasonable cost, which meant like $1 a record, and they turn around and sell it for $10 a record. So one of our arguments is that, you know, the government spends a great deal of energy and resources compiling information that is in the public domain, and the taxpayer really ought to get some pecuniary benefit from that if it is going to be sold for any public purpose. So that's a really huge problem that we're grappling with right now, is who controls information. When you boil it back down to consolidation, who is going to be the data custodian? Is it going to be the chief information officer? Is it going to be a cabinet-level department head? Is it going to be the archivist or the record keeper? And that's where a lot of the fights have happened in the past. One of the things we learned through the process of defining what our archivist was going to do is that there was no clear jurisdiction over information. And the archivist was just sort of there, another senior government official decided they needed some more space in a particular cage that had some boxes in it, so they threw them all away, which affected the pensions of about 10,000 former state employees. So that's a critical point, maybe more critical than anything else, is who is responsible for that data and who has access to it.
And the CIOs, quite frankly, do not this is a debate. They don't want to be – they're not the custodians of agency data. The issue with consolidation is then they're the single point of contact for e-discovery, for subpoenas, because they're running the environment. But they need to set up service-level agreements that clearly, if it's an agency and they're hosting all that data, the CIOs do not want to be in a situation where they're responding for that. But they find themselves caught because – They are the ones that have access to the system. So Matt's right. It's become a major challenge and discussion.
Jackie just turned you off, so I'm going to let her talk now.
I actually want to talk from silo land. I'm loving hearing this conversation at this wonderful level, but just to bring us to a more realistic point of view where I come from, we've got 3,068 counties. 2,000, well, yeah, that's been said. 2,000 of them have less than 50,000 population. Some of those counties with less than 50,000 population have 6 or 7 constitutionally elected officers, and they all maintain their own records. That's why I said, let's bring a yoo-hoo from silo land. What we are aiming for is just to get all of the county records in one place. Because we get asked all the time, and this is a very basic question that everybody wants to know the answer to, how much does County X spend on IT? Who knows? It's buried in 12 different budgetary line items. What we are working on is just consolidation at the county level. We're not even anywhere near where he is. His ION at the state level is light years beyond where counties are. And part of the problem is, depending on the activity of the department, there are frequently state mandates as to what software and what programs and what systems are used to maintain the records, starting with the sheriff's department. The state crime office is the first place that computerized most counties. Back in the days when nobody knew computers, the only person who knew how to really set up computers and work them was the chief deputy in the sheriff's department, because that chief deputy is the one that got the computers from the state and knew how to do things. So the reality is human services gets their directions from DFACS at the state level, so their records will interact. So you can see how complicated it can be, especially when the state level has not consolidated its records. Everybody's trying to follow what master is yanking their chains and giving them their money. So consolidation is something we're just trying to get in the county, never mind all over the state. We are working right now just to make sure that everybody can talk to each other at the county level. The fire people can talk to the county people, and the county people can talk to the social workers so they can get them there. And that is a difficult thing, especially in our smaller counties. Now, I'm not talking about the biggest counties. Some of our bigger counties are bigger than states. I'm talking about Los Angeles and Cook and New York and those kinds of places. They're working. They're smoking, except San Diego pulled the boo-boo. They outsourced everything. And within 2 years, they brought all IT-wise. They had to bring it all back because it was a fiasco, because they couldn't get the contract specs and the oversight right. So they had to bring it back in. So I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm thinking it's a great idea. But in our silo world, a lot of our people are having to crawl before they can walk. And every last one of them is maintaining some kind of record that has to do with somebody. I had a young woman call me last week. It was pretty funny. I don't know how she got to me. And she was all upset because her boyfriend was supposed to get out of jail. You'd be surprised at the weird calls I get sometimes. And she said he was supposed to get out of jail last Thursday, and I want to know why they haven't let him out of jail. And I said, well, what did they tell you? They said, well, the judge that had to sign the release order was on vacation. And I said, where is this? And this was a very small community, and nobody else wanted to step up and sign it. So he's sitting in jail, and his, apparently, according to her, his term is over. His sentence is over. But when the judge comes back from his fishing trip, he'll let him out. Well, you know, the reality is that's still going on. And the records somewhere along the way got lost, because that should have been signed before it was his day to get out. Somebody should have been monitoring that. You shouldn't still be in jail. And think about that. She's mad because he's in jail. Guess who's still paying the bills, feeding him every day? $62 a day because of poor record keeping. Nobody got the records where they are. This is the reality in a lot of our counties, and we are working very hard to get them to work at a level. We have IT people. We actually have had, through our organization, IBM step in and maintain the service so they could have websites. And they put their data on the IBM website. IBM created a prototype. They filled in the blanks so that they could have their data on the website. But the reality is we are really working hard to make sure that everything talks to each other and trying just organizing the records under the recorder's office. Because who has the records? The registrar, the recorder, the treasurer, the assessor, who's got records? The court system, there's records everywhere. We want a county-maintained record system. And many of our larger counties and mid-sized counties have that. But our smaller counties are still out there in the wilderness working in their little silos. So I just thought I'd speak out from silo.
Let's go to another end of the okay. spectrum here, where we also probably find a few silos. How about the national level? This kind of issue, I'd like to hear from Adrian on how the National Archives approaches this kind of issue. There's no federal consolidation, I assume, federal-wide, and you're dealing with the electronic records from many different agencies and such.
Absolutely. So. Every agency has responsibility for their own records and their IT systems. There are, of course, the rules that OMB, Office of Management and Budget, puts out. Comes and goes, too, about what those rules are going to be. And there is an effort right now to consolidate data centers, mainly because of efficiency, cost cutting. There are a zillion rules on IT security. I mean, it's like there's, you know, a new batch of rules that comes out every week. All of them cost more. While the agencies are in control of their own systems, they're sort of not in control of how they have to develop those systems because they have to follow these rules. There's a lot more transparency about what they're developing and what the status of those records are by the creation of the dashboard. Mm-hmm. And you can see online agencies from the CIOs, has the CIO's picture on it, so you know who they are, how to contact them, shows what kind of systems they are developing and whether they are in trouble or not in trouble and why and so forth, so that you can get a lot more information about what's going on. But still, in the end, each agency is basically responsible for their own systems. So when the National Archives has to send its records managers out to deal with these people, it's with each individual agency. There isn't any, you know, you pick the biggest ones, obviously, or the most important ones, but and I'm not sure you could ever get consolidation. We also deal, of course, with the Congress, congressional records. The National Archives gets congressional records, gets court records, and gets records from the executive branch. There's been an effort underway over the past, I'd say, two or three years. It's been fairly recent, where the Secretary of the Senate and the Clerk of the House, who are in charge of the administrative apparatus of the Congress in their respective houses, have undertaken their own sort of records management assessment of the electronic records that are being created at the committee level. And every committee is responsible for their own IT systems. And so they're trying to determine what's out there and get it transferred to the National Archives. So there's no consolidation in the federal government broadly speaking. There's some areas like the data centers, but mainly it's
there can be
a
pros
lot of
and
silos.
Cons on consolidation.
Yeah.
Well, and I think how that affects the states is when you're – when we're talking about federal mandates that come down, they often are cross-threaded against each other. You know, when you have a mandate for, you know, securing types of information from public dissemination versus making things more widely available, and then the federal government frequently conveniently exempts itself from those same types of rules, so that, you know, getting back to, you know, issue of identity, you know, since the Supreme Court decision on the Indiana case about voter identification laws, you know, what that translates into is still very much in the unknown, which, for those of you who are unfamiliar with that, there is a law that in Indiana that mandated that you had to present photo ID in order to obtain a ballot. Went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld that as constitutional, which opens a whole floodgate of unanswered questions, such as, if you have to have a photo ID provided by the government, can the government charge for that, or is that a poll tax? If you're using a driver's license or a state ID card, does it fall under that? Which in Maine, you know, one state that would face that, about a $6.5 million hole kicked into the side of the highway fund. And or if you're going to issue a, you know, a voter ID card, what is that going to consist of based on what information from either the federal government or, you know, the county birth records? Where are those? Under the earlier iterations of the Real ID Act, which are still out there, it's never been repealed, it's not yet been fully implemented, state motor vehicle officials are required under the Act to actually verify birth certificates, not just look at them and check off a box. Yeah, I saw, you know, David Carmichael's birth certificate. Actually verify from its source that it's authentic. That could be a problem in those jurisdictions that have sporadically issued birth certificates, or birth certificates issued in foreign countries that no longer exist, like East Germany, the former Soviet republics, Rhodesia comes to mind. So there's no way to verify those types of records, which really leaves, you know, records officials scratching their heads. And there's an apartment building up the street from me in Old Town, Maine, that used to be a private hospital. People were born there. What happened to the records, and how do you – and we confront that all the time in my business. People who cannot meet the federal standards for identifying that they're in the country legally or that they're citizens, and we have to go through an enormous amount of handwork to get them through that process so that they can obtain, you know, an identity card. And that's only going to become more problematic as the years go by, as what, like, you know, fingerprinting, iris scans, what people will be expected to provide. And then when their identity is stolen, how do you repair that? That's going to be another major issue, which we're not even going to talk about today.
No time for that. I have about 20 more questions, and I can't do them because we're running out of time. I want to give you a chance to ask questions. And if you don't have any, I've got a lot more. But do you have a question that you'd like to ask the panel? Okay, and the question was, we talked about privacy and access and measuring public, what was the word you used?
Tolerance.
Tolerance for that. How do you measure the public tolerance for that? Where do you draw the line? I need to repeat the question for the recording here. So,
well, I think that's actually pretty easy. If it involves the government, people don't trust it. You know, when you go to Disney and you get your pass, you provide a thumbprint. And then to get into Disney, you swipe the card, put your thumbprint on the reader, and you walk right in. Nobody ever questions it because it's Disney. You know, if the Maine Turnpike Authority did that, they'd be marching on the Capitol with pitchforks and torches. You know, so that's really the bright line. If the government is asking for information about you, people are naturally suspicious because they don't really trust the government. So that's a huge area. And whenever somebody runs for public office and says, what we need to do is run government like a business, I laugh because we're not a business. I worked in restaurants for 20 years. If you have a dish that's not popular, you take it off the menu. Everything we do is unpopular. We suspend driver's licenses. We take children out of abusive homes. People love that when we do that. And it's, you know, you can't take those unpopular product lines off the table. That's the government's job, is to do those things that need to be done. And that sometimes includes collecting information and utilizing it for legal purposes. You know, we put license plates on motor vehicles so we can check who's driving them. So, and people don't necessarily enjoy that type of scrutiny, and they question it, and I think that's a healthy part of the democracy. But they also demand that everyone else is complying with the laws, too. You know, that's that tough balancing point between access of information, availability of information, but they also don't want some unknown person in an unknown place for an unknown reason looking at my records. You know, when the presidential primary a couple of years back, when it came out, the State Department employees, contractors, were looking at the travel records of presidential candidates. People were scandalized by that. They're just curious. You know, in our bureau, when people look at other people's driving records for no particular reason, we fire them. That's a violation of our privacy statutes. So there are safeguards. It's whether or not they're enough for the public to stomach and whether or not they provide sufficient safeguards from abuse of information. And there is a vast difference between what the private sector does. People have no problem giving their Social Security number to a store clerk when they're doing a purchase return, you know. But if I ask them for their Social Security number, what do you want that for? You know, I don't need to give you that. So, you know, I think that's the bright line from what I've seen.
I sort of agree with him, and I love the statement. They want to be able to, or the same thing I said. You want to be able to get your information easily, but you don't want anybody else to have that same kind of access. An article, right or wrong, that somebody got your information from a county website and they stole somebody's ID. That's the kind of thing that's an uproar. And people in counties live closer to their people than they do at the state level. And you don't always hear about it in the commission meeting. You might hear it in line at the dry cleaners. And public opinion, gossip, wrong or right, will let you know very quickly how people feel about the accessibility of a new piece of software you put up with something. But the reality of it is you'll find out if people don't like it. And I agree 100%. I love that new commercial they've got. Have you seen this commercial where these people are trying to open a bank account and they ask, what was the name of your last boyfriend? What did you break up with him for? I mean, all kinds of personal information. And they're just filling it out. And look at the census. Now, I had to bring that up because I'm on the Census Advisory Committee. That's the federal government asking 10 questions that really didn't ask a lot of information this time. I will share that it's a lot less intrusive than it had been in the past with the long form. And people were just berserk. It's an invasion of my privacy. Plus, you have to deal with the people who have come to this country from other countries where the reality of their existence is you don't give your personal information to the government because you don't know who's going to come knocking on your door and get things. So people have their own personal level of sensitivity about the availability of their personal information that you collect as a governmental agency. And we collect it, and the same sort of situation. I call it the Edsel syndrome. Anybody remember the Edsel? Ford could stop making the Edsel because it was a flop, but government can't stop doing the things it does because it has to.
And even among genealogists, you know, sometimes people don't want everyone to know about their ancestry. You remember Nathaniel Hawthorne changed his name. His name was not Hawthorne. It was Hathorne. But his grandfather was a presiding judge at the Salem witch trials, and he didn't want people to know that. So, I mean, sometimes people purposely don't want public records to reflect their past for whatever reason.
I'm going to regret this, but I do agree
Go
with
ahead.
Matt. no.
One in a row.
this is the last time. One of the challenges around this is the fundamental privacy construct that people have really started to corrupt to a great degree. I mean, look at Supreme Court decisions. It has really to do with the right to be left alone, and yet people want to take advantage of a proliferation of government services which they feel entitled to. We have entitlement programs. So they feel entitled to all these programs, and yet they're unwilling to provide the necessary information. And the reality of both local and particularly state governments is in some cases, states would have to work very, very hard to invade your privacy from a data perspective because of the silos. We like to call them cylinders of excellence, by the way. and the challenge of that is, and I think this is the reality on the ground, is that government, particularly state and local governments, do not do a very good job with data management. Okay, they don't manage their data very well because it's, again, part of it is the cost issue, part of it is the silo issue. We've created silos, and in fact, to Matt's point, we've created silos of identity. We have multiple, you have a proliferation of credentials that you're required, and that is one of the areas that we'd like to focus on from our organization in the future, is how, as organizations and as state officials, we can collaborate to begin to harmonize all these different identities and come up with a way that is very cost-effective yet not privacy-invasive. And I think it's going to be a challenge, but I do agree with Matt. It's amazing for convenience and for market capabilities what people will give up, and yet they're reluctant because they fundamentally believe that under the covers that there's a seamless sharing of their personal information among state agencies. I'm telling you, folks, it doesn't exist in most cases. It's there are, and again, that's down to issues around disciplines, around standards. And if you haven't heard of NEEM, that certainly we're on the advocacy bandwagon at NASIO around the National Information Exchange Model, because we believe that that creates that conformance, that core content around identity that is important for, again, both security and privacy, because we need to stop having so many variations on the same theme, and that, again, the public at large believe that's a George Orwell issue, and they're scared at that. But the reality is that in order to optimize services, we need to figure out how to remove all this duplication and redundancy. And if you've ever had the opportunity to sit down in front of five different state systems and look at your own personal information, you'll find three different versions of the truth in those five systems. So that's a challenge.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to another question. I do want Matt to know that I'm starting a campaign, Let's Run Business Like the Government. that should tank the country.
Great.
I have to summarize the question for those who can't hear it. Thank you. What are some successful models where archivists and records managers have worked with information technology and others to say it again?
How our skill sets can be incorporated with yours.
Thank you. How our skill sets can be incorporated with theirs.
Well, I would. There's a number of states, but I would, I think some folks at COSA have heard this before. One of the disciplines, obviously, for the last decade that state CIO organizations and other agencies have adopted is enterprise architecture around domains of business and business reference models around the processes. And it's really not the technology issues. It's around business process. And certainly I think that states that are forward-looking and have embraced that are ones where electronic records managers and the archivists are on enterprise architecture domain teams. Kansas is one, and I think that reflects that. So in their actual documentation, but more importantly in their processes and their vitality around looking at those, that they're looking at them on a regular basis and examining those issues and implications for new technologies. And I think as you look at the opportunities both near term and certainly in the next 5 years, the one that I would be remiss if I didn't bring up and where the forecast is very sunny, and that is in cloud computing. Mm-hmm. And there's a host of implications around records management and digital preservation and archiving around where states are going with the cloud. And whether it's a private cloud or whether it's, by that I mean operated, hosted and operated by the state, but our recent survey where we examined this, we found about 20% of the states are actively involved in a cloud project, and so once that's the next iteration. Unfortunately, it doesn't end in TION, so I don't know what to do with that. but that's the infrastructure
foundation.
Optimization. The states that have
precipitation,
right? That could be a problem. States that have gone to a consolidation level at a very high degree are now looking to move to the cloud, and this is an area where the federal government, in fact, I think the survey that I saw a few months ago, 50%. Of the federal agencies now have some active cloud project. I met with GSA yesterday, and we've been working with them on an opportunity with their cloud proposal, their cloud contracts. They'll be releasing those to state and local government availability sometime in September, and that will provide a whole set of blanket purchase of BPAs that, that state and locals can buy cloud services. And I think that's going to be the next, you know, kind of emerging issue that all of you need to look at, because I see it has tremendous implications around the whole records management in the digital world, and the custodian issues and where they reside. And we have states today, one state agency which moved 700,000 emails to the cloud, and it's being run, you know, in state that's, you know, 500, 800 miles away. So different way of thinking for the future.
Thank you.
I just would add to that. I mean, I think the partnerships there are quite critical, but I still think that the role of the archivist and the records manager should be kept quite focused and not become a shop, a one-stop shop where you get all information managed there. It'll become unmanageable. When we were creating the program evaluation office in our state, we were told by other states, whatever you do, don't let these guys write fiscal notes, because that's wind up being all they're going to do. And we actually had a separate office. And we thought, you know, nobody ever considered the name of the Office of Fiscal and Program Review. They didn't do any program review. All they did was write fiscal notes. So you don't want to put the archivist or the records management team into a trap where all they're doing is trying to provide access to information and upgrade technologies, when really they should be focused on, you know, in, at least in my view, you know, making sure that records are preserved and that, you know, the business practices are kept up to date, so that we don't lose columns of records inadvertently. The technology is changing so swiftly, I'm happy to leave that to the people who specialize in technology and then leave the records to the people who specialize in records and have them collaborate in the best way to platform things publicly.
I wish we had about 4 hours to do this, because there's so many other things we could be doing. However, I want to give the last little bit of time here to one person. Bob Martin is in the audience here, and at one time he was going to be on the panel, and SAA said we couldn't have five. So I said, well, you can still be in the audience and comment. And most of you know Bob. He was director of the Texas State Library and Archives. He was the director of IMLS here in Washington. He is on the National Council on the Humanities and has just been a long, long time friend, and I think very articulate observer of archives and many of the issues we face. So I'd ask him if at the end he would come up for 5 minutes and or so and just talk about sort of what he saw in all of these issues. So, Bob, if you come and take a few minutes, and then I'll wrap us up.
Well, thank you very much for that for those kind remarks. I'm not sure why David wanted me to do this. I think he forgot, though, that when he originally invited me to be on the panel, I said, no, I'm going to be in Gothenburg, Sweden, for the International Federation of Library Associations meeting, which is going on in Sweden right now, and it's a lot cooler there than it is here. probably not raining. I don't know. I have very little to add to this really extraordinary conversation, wide-ranging and both broad and deep, touching on so many really important issues. I'll limit my remarks to 4 or 5 points and in no particular order. Early on in the sort of opening comments from each of the panelists, it struck me that one of the things that they were differentiating is audience. Who are their customers? Who are your clients? Who are your stakeholders? Whose needs are you addressing? And, of course, archivists know that they address a wide range of clients or customers, and that each of those have different abilities to sanction what we do, to provide resources for what we do, and they all have widely varying needs and demands. Elected officials have one set of needs and demands and one window on who we are and what we do, whereas agency heads have yet another, and, of course, the general public has yet a very different one. Quoting a note that we got early on from David about this, the ever-increasing appetite of the public for new and different ways to connect and interact virtually with others or to contribute with your web presence. So this kind of opportunity and challenge, the flip sides of the information technology coin as it affects our ability to provide access. Secretary Dunlap made a very interesting comment, which I think I can quote accurately. Technology is easy. Politics are hard. And, of course, any of us who have operated in that environment know that there's a great deal of truth to that, but I think I would, at least personally, resist ever saying that technology is easy. Technology is easier than the politics, though, to be sure. And most of the problems that we deal with in developing our systems and processes, the technology is the easier part. It's the getting consensus on what our goals and outcomes are and figuring out the roadmap on how to get there and getting everybody on board and moving in the same direction is the hard part. One of the things that I didn't hear, or at least only heard sort of tangentially, was the in all of the discussion of consolidation and silo land and cylinders of excellence, yes, is I think one of the things that we need to move towards, and I think we were starting to get there right at the end when you started talking about cloud computing, is the redundancy of effort and structure across different levels of government, particularly, for example, at the county level. By the way, of those 3,500 counties, 254 of them are in Texas.
Yes,
you probably know that. And
Georgia.
I think one of the largest and perhaps one of the smallest is in Texas.
Loving County, Texas.
The Loving County is famous for having more cows than people, quite a few more cows than people, actually. All of these counties, all of the county officials do the same thing. Pretty much, you know, 99% of what they do is the same. And there's an opportunity here, particularly as we might move into the cloud, for really finding some synergies and resource savings as we move in that direction. I was very interested in the discussion of privacy and access and the whole issue about trust in government and Secretary Dunlap's observation, very accurate observation, that we readily give up to Disney what we reluctantly would provide to the state. And there's an even better example, I think, what we readily give up to Google. Mm-hmm. I recently acquired my first smartphone, and I got the Droid, and now Google knows everything about me. Right at the moment, they know precisely where I'm standing because I've got the GPS function operating on that app is operating on my phone, and even if you don't have a mobile phone with all of the apps enabled, every time you hit the search in Google or Yahoo or any of the other ones, they're collecting that data and they're sharing it and they're selling it. The Wall Street Journal has been running a series of articles on what they know, and the they is the Amazoogle complex of vendors, and what they know is a lot, and we're happy to give it to them in order to do all the things we do online. And it is a remarkable puzzle as to why we are so ready to essentially forego privacy in the online commercial arena and yet are very concerned about privacy in the online government arena. It's a puzzle. And I think I'll close with just one observation that derives from my own perspective as a erstwhile educator, being a professor emeritus in the School of Library and Information Studies, and that is what all of this stuff we've been talking about today, how it relates to the preparation of the next generation of information professionals, archival professionals. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's an important one, and it's one that we ought to all engage in as we move forward. Obviously, the aptitudes and skill sets of the people who are going to be managing the things that we have been talking about this morning are very different from those that people of my generation were expected to have and master coming into the profession. And we need to be very focused on making sure that we are preparing people, we are recruiting people with the right attitudes and aptitudes, and that we are preparing them properly for professional practice. And I think I'll stop at that, David.
Now you understand why I asked him to comment right at the end. I think we've raised far more questions than we've answered today, which we expected. Part of this was just kind of to provoke thought, and it's kind of early in the morning to be provoking thought, but hopefully we've been provoking you to some extent. I have only time to thank you for coming out to this session and to ask you to join me in thanking this wonderful panel for their work today as well. Thank you all very much. Have a good day.